From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Mia Farrow, on growing up the daughter of a movie star, becoming a star herself, marrying an icon, Frank Sinatra, adopting many children, and her bitter separation from Woody Allen. She's written a new memoir called What Falls Away. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new reissue of New and Old Gospel, featuring Jackie McLean and Ornette Coleman, recorded 30 years ago. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Hundreds of people are unaccounted for and more than 30 are known to have died in mudslides in the Peruvian Andes. John Miller reports from Lima.
Civil defense workers are searching through millions of cubic feet of mud and boulders in search of victims of yesterday's landslides. The main slide came early Tuesday morning, about 380 miles southeast of Lima, as heavy rains caused a mountainside to collapse. Two villages were buried. There have been conflicting reports over how many people were evacuated prior to the disaster. Some of the victims had reportedly left their homes and taken shelter in a narrow valley, only to be buried by the wall of mud. Rescue workers from the military, police, and fire departments are flying in food and medical supplies to hundreds of people camping out in tents. Rain has caused heavy flooding and landslides throughout the Andes and Peru's central jungle this week. Officials say the amount of rainfall is not unusual, and more rain is predicted for the coming days. For National Public Radio, I'm John Miller in Lima.
Consumer prices moved up slightly last month, increasing by just 0.1%. It was the smallest rise since last summer. Economist Robert Diedrich says today's report indicates that inflation is under control.
Inflation remains very well contained. Here we are, 6 years almost over in this expansion, and we're still having inflation numbers that we'd think would occur at the bottom of a recession. This is a remarkable upturn, and I hope that we're sitting back and enjoying it.
The Labor Department says food prices fell last month by 0.3%, the largest decline in 3.5 years. The jury in the John DuPont murder trial has begun its second day of deliberations. That issue is whether DuPont was legally insane when he shot and killed an Olympic wrestler. NPR's Eric Westervelt reports.
Neither side disputes that John DuPont killed gold medal wrestler Dave Schultz or that DuPont was mentally ill when he did it. But the jury is assessing whether DuPont was legally insane, whether he knew right from wrong when he pulled the trigger of his .44 Magnum last January. The defense says the murder was the culminating act of a paranoid schizophrenic whose psychotic delusions of a shadow conspiracy drove him to kill. But the prosecution says DuPont acted out of jealousy, rage, and drug abuse. One of the richest Americans ever tried for murder, the prosecution told jurors DuPont was trying to use his $260 million to escape justice. In addition to guilty and not guilty by reason of insanity, the jury could find DuPont guilty but mentally ill, which means he'd get some treatment, then serve a regular prison term. This is Eric Westervelt.
The Hubble Space Telescope has been released back into its own orbit. The astronauts aboard the Space Shuttle Discovery completed a number of upgrades and repairs on the observatory. It'll take scientists a few weeks to see how those changes affect the pictures and data Hubble is gathering. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 8 points at 7,059 in heavy trading of 232 million shares. The Nasdaq Composite Index is up a fraction of a point. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, it's been a volatile morning in the stock market after yesterday's record-setting session. More from Bloomberg's Doug Krisner.
Computer system stocks are higher after surprisingly strong earnings from Hewlett-Packard. However, many interest rate-sensitive issues, like banks, financial services, and electric utilities, are lower, thanks to an increase in long-term interest rates. The day's economic news suggests restrained economic growth and subdued inflation. Consumer prices barely budged last month, while the level of trade exports slowed during December. I'm Doug Krisner.
The nation's foreign trade deficit surged to over $114 billion last year. That's the worst performance since 1988. The deficit with China hit an all-time high, and the price of crude oil rose to the highest level in 6 years. The Commerce Department says the deficit in goods and services for all of last year was up nearly 9%. The U.S. trade deficit has risen every year that President Clinton has been in office. Critics contend the rising deficits have cost millions of American jobs. British Foreign Secretary Malcolm Rifkin is warning that the planned single currency for Europe should not proceed without more widespread support. Rifkin says what the European Union is contemplating is a change that will not unite but divide its member states. Rifkin was speaking in Bonn. His comments got a cool reception from the German journalists and government officials present. 10 computer dealers in Singapore have taken out a full-page newspaper advertisement to apologize to the Microsoft Corporation. The dealers say they're sorry for loading pirated Microsoft software onto personal computers they sold. The ad is part of an out-of-court settlement that also includes a $160,000 cash settlement and donation of computers to children's charities. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations. Contributors include the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve health and health care for all Americans.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. 4.5 years ago, while she was working with Woody Allen on the film Husbands and Wives, Mia Farrow discovered Woody Allen was sleeping with her adopted daughter, Soon Yi. The scandal threatened to ruin Mia Farrow's life and eclipse every aspect of her work. Although it is not a subject she's been anxious to publicly discuss, she concludes her new memoir with a description of her break from Allen. But her memoir, called What Falls Away, also chronicles the rest of her very eventful life, growing up the daughter of a movie star, Maureen O'Sullivan, establishing her own acting career, her marriages to Frank Sinatra and Andre Previn, and her constantly expanding family of adopted children. I asked Mia Farrow why, after trying to stay out of the public eye, she wrote a memoir.
Well, so much had been said in recent years, and not by me, that I felt almost compelled to set down not just these recent events, but all the events of my life, so that, you know, I have a 3-year-old, and I wanted the story to be told truthfully, so that my children would have an account of the events that shaped my life and shaped our family. So really, I mean, I almost see it as a note in a bottle to my children. I wish I'd had that from my mother or my grandmother. I thought it would be a good thing. Also, it was a time in my life when I thought it would be beneficial to me to gain a little perspective and try writing about it.
Well, your book starts at the age of 9 in 1954 when you contracted polio. Mm-hmm. Are there aspects of your personality or your body that you feel were shaped by that experience?
Absolutely. I'm most particular. I mean, I was lucky in that I was not debilitated by the disease, but so it was a relatively mild case. But I do feel that it shaped the way I look at life and the sorts of things that I tried to achieve in my life. Namely my family, the children that I have, and the disabilities that my children have. I mean, these things I'm sure came out of my perception of the world and the responsibility that I felt to try to assist in some way. I'm sure this came out of the polio wards.
So you think that you consciously went about trying to adopt children with disabilities because of having polio when you were young?
Or unconsciously, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I see it all now as more one coherent picture, mm-hmm. you know, that the sorts of things I wrestled with, the impressions that were made, the conclusions I made, all those observations from my time in the hospital and the effects of polio. I mean, the fear that everybody had, not only of the disease, but of me for you know, a good year or two after I came back to school. All of those things are personality shaping.
Your parents both worked in Hollywood. Your mother, Maureen O'Sullivan, first became famous for her 6 Tarzan movies, including the 1934 Tarzan and His Mate. Now, wasn't the 1934 one the one like before the Hollywood Code, when she was wearing a lot less than she could have gotten away with later?
Yeah, that's very observant of you. I think that the first stills of my mother, she was in quite a racy several pieces of leather strategically stitched together, and then they amended that outfit. And the subsequent movies, she was, you know, in a almost knee length and fully covered up suit of leather. So the first movie she was very skimpily clad.
Which did she prefer? Do you know?
I don't know. She had a great figure, so I think she was, you know, quite happy to show it off. And then she was rather amused at the prudishness of the film industry making her cover up. And, you know, she was young. She didn't really care. She thought the job was fun.
I saw so many of those Tarzan movies when I was young on television. I'm wondering if you saw those, too, and what it was like to see your mother in them.
It was funny. It was hard to put it together with the mother I knew and loved. And then, you know, now seeing them with my children, I said, look, kids, there's Grandma. They're in the trees. And they stare with open mouths, you know. Is that Grandma on that elephant? So, you know, it's fun. It's fun seeing her like that. I asked her what it felt like to look at herself at that age. And she said it's like not me, but somebody that I'm fond of, you know, that I have memories of, but that isn't me.
Did you think your mother was beautiful when you were young?
I thought she was gorgeous. I thought she was the most beautiful woman I'd ever seen. And in fact, she was.
Did you think you were beautiful when you were young?
Oh, no, not for a second. And I, in fact, I wasn't. As I was a rather plain little girl.
Did that matter to you since your mother was so beautiful?
No, at that point, I didn't care. I spent my time wishing that I was a boy.
What?
I was surrounded by brothers. I had two older brothers and a younger brother, and I wanted to do all the things they could do. You know, I carried water for the Little League. I wanted to outrun them and, you know, outride my bike. And I was a little tomboy. I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about my looks.
When you were a teenager, your mother said that you were lucky because you could look plain and with help could pass for pretty. This was during your very early acting career. What did you make of that statement? Did you take that as a compliment or as a...
I took it from her as a professional bit of advice or
right.
observation. So
right.
I thought, oh, okay. You know, that was decent of her to tell me. You know, I think she meant it as a compliment, a practicality as I entered the business.
That you could play it both ways in roles, and
right.
that could be a really good thing.
Right. And it turned out she was correct about that, you know, that I found that's so.
Mia Farrow is my guest. She's written a new autobiography called What Falls Away. Now, your father was a director and screenwriter. He directed The Big Clock, which your mother acted in. He directed His Kind of Woman with Robert Mitchum, wrote the screenplay for Around the World in 80 Days. You describe your father as a devout Catholic and a womanizer of legendary proportion. How did you know that he was a womanizer?
Well, I came upon my mother with a woman. I came into his dressing room and I...
You came upon your father or your mother?
Yeah, my father. I went into his dressing room once and he was with a woman. Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, as I grew up, I encountered a lot of women around town who would come up to me and say, you know, I knew your father, kind of in a special way, and I just never knew what to say to them. Also, I overheard certain, you know, conversations between my parents, so I had a pretty good idea, you know, at a fairly early age.
How did you feel about that as a child?
As a child, I tried to make no judgment. You know, it was just one of those... I don't know. I was that sort of child that didn't pass judgment. It was as if I was watching television so much of my childhood. I just felt I was watching television, and that's the way things were, and I couldn't change the channel.
Did you feel like you were watching television because your parents' work was on television?
No. No, I think it was more just the way I was. I was very, very intense, and when things got emotional around me, if, say, I overheard something between my parents that was more than I could deal with, I had this feeling of being detached but being overwhelmed at the same time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I was just caught in a moment in which I was not a player. But, you know, I was an observer, a witness.
What did you pick up from your mother about how to deal with something like that in the family? Was your mother forgiving about your father? Was she constantly angry with him and very jealous?
She was alternately all of those things, but her overall philosophy was obviously, I mean, she was going to stay with him, and she had a separate entrance put into our house so that she wouldn't be awakened when he came and went. And he had his own bedroom. So, you know, they just, I guess, made their peace with it. I don't think she ever really fully adjusted. I don't think one can, but she didn't leave him.
Your mother retired from the screen in 1958. Why did she?
Well, I think two things. I mean, primarily, she reached a certain age, and the parts weren't there.
Mm-hmm.
And she was not an ambitious woman. You know, she did sort of the minimum. She never really pursued a career. Things sort of fell her way, but she was not very ambitious. So I think she's quite happy, you know, to be supported by my father.
When
you have to be home.
When your father died, your mother had to support the family. How old was she then, and what kind of work did she do?
She was in her early 50s, and she was in a play on Broadway.
And how old were you when your father died?
I was 17.
And that's when you decided you had to go to work to support yourself?
I thought it best. I mean, it didn't seem that I could go back to school, given, you know, we had financial problems, and I thought that the best thing I could do would be to try to get a job and at least carry my own weight and, if possible, help my mother with the younger kids.
Now, did you really want to act, or did you just want to help support the family?
Well, you know, I'd been okay at acting in school. I'd found it fun, and I found, you know, a measure of success doing it. I'd won some prizes, and, you know, in school plays, I was given the good roles. So I knew it was something that I could do, but it was a little premature at 17. I mean, I had assumed that I would go to college and, you know, figure it all out later. I had an overriding dream at the time that I would become a pediatrician and work with children in Southeast Asia or Africa or somewhere. So, you know, this sort of blew that dream out of the water, and I thought I'd give acting a shot because, you know, I was completely ill-equipped to do anything else. I was, you know, just a high school graduate.
So even at that age, you saw a lot of children in your life.
Yes.
So you thought it would be as a doctor.
Yes.
You write in your memoir that the first time you were in bed with a man, it was on a movie set. it was a scene that you were shooting. Tell us about the scene and what that experience was like for you.
Well, there was a sort of, looking back, a surreal aspect to it. You know, it was odd that the first time I was in bed with a man was, you know, on a movie set surrounded by, you know, 40-odd people and lights and a man I didn't know. And it was just it, sort of typical of my life, you know, and that would be, you know. I just pointed out as an oddity, another passing strangeness.
Who was the actor? What was the scene?
His name was Johnny Layton, an English actor in an English film starring Richard Attenborough. And, you know, it was a little film called Guns at Batassi, actually a fine black and white film by directed by John Gillerman.
Did you blush?
I'm sure I did. Yes, I was absolutely mortified. Mortified. It was. I taped pieces of material. You know, I covered myself. I was actually, you know, in more than a bathing suit, you know, down to my knees. But I just reinforced that with masking tape so that nothing would come unstuck. And, you know, it was about the most agonizing experience I'd had to date.
My guest is Mia Farrow. She's written a new memoir called What Falls Away. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Mia Farrow is my guest, and her new memoir is called What Falls Away. How did you land the part in Peyton Place, the TV series that was, it was like the first primetime soap opera, and it really established you at a very young age? You were what, 19, 18?
Well, the first show, yeah, I was 18. I was 18 when we started. I'd done this this play, The Importance of Being Earnest, off Broadway. That was my first job, and Vivian Lee, a friend of my mother's, also appearing on Broadway, sent people around to see my performance, which was extraordinarily generous of her and supportive. So you know, I have to credit her for getting me the work. And among the people she sent were casting directors, and they sent someone from 20th Century Fox who thought I'd be right for Peyton Place, and also for the movie that I just described with the agonizing love scene. So I got both out of being in that play, the Importance of Being Earnest.
Well, I used to watch Peyton Place all the time during its first few years. You played Allison McKenzie. I'll ask you to describe your character.
An introvert, you know, very introspective, shy, and perhaps a typical bookworm, introverted teenager, you know, agonizing about all the existential things and dating and the relationship with her mother. I mean, all of that. So I was the tortured teenager.
So did people start to confuse you with your character? Was this your first experience with that?
Well, I think they did confuse me because I got a lot of letters addressed to someone. Well, you know, I wasn't unlike that character. You know, I think I had other dimensions that were not shown on Peyton Place, but I was not unlike that character at that time. And it was real clear to me when I met and began dating my first husband, people were outraged because they thought I was this 16-year-old little, you know. In a way, I sort of was, you know, really, really innocent. And then, you know, my first husband was this so-called swinger, 50-year-old. People really got me mixed up with the character.
Your first husband was Frank Sinatra.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and before we talk about Sinatra, I just have another question about Peyton Place, and it has to do with your hair, which you tell the story of in your memoir. You had, when the Peyton Place series started, this like long straight blonde hair that was the envy of many teenage girls. Then all of a sudden it was incredibly short, just like shorter than anyone had seen haircuts on women. You cut it yourself. What came over you?
Nothing. I mean, it's such a non-event. I can't believe, you know, 30 years after the fact, it's still worth talking about. It was the days of flips and bubbles. These were the styles of the day. So I had this long hair really out of neglect. You know, I had just not, you know, I couldn't be bothered to curl it or cut it or have it styled or anything. I'd never been to a hairdresser. So I got a lot of mail on the subject of my hair, and I found that while it was pleasurable, it was also disturbing because I, you know, was this Catholic convent school girl, and I thought to be complimented. I mean, I thought it would make me vain. I thought it was a destructive thing. So I'd recently seen Member of the Wedding with Julie Harris. I thought, well, you know, that's a good idea. Just get rid of it entirely. So I cut it off at a point in the show when I was supposedly having this nervous breakdown on Peyton Place. So I thought it was a good time. The storyline could accommodate it easily. And I cut it off, you know, and to my astonishment, it must have been nothing going on that day and that week because, you know, people wrote about it and it was such a hoo-ha, which I never, to this day, I can't believe you're bringing it up. You know, I couldn't understand.
I just remember. I remember it. I remember the event.
You remember the hoo-ha. Well, you know, it was inexplicable.
Yeah, but I'm wondering if like the there was calamity on the set, and if the hairdresser recut your own haircut.
Well, truthfully, there was a bit of a calamity, but it was altogether needless. I mean, the producers made a big fuss over it, and they thought it was a catastrophe. They'd never seen a haircut like that, and hairdressers rushed in with wigs and, you know, to see if they could fix the situation somehow. But I really had cut it a half an inch at the most in length. So there wasn't much that could be done. You know, maybe the hairdresser might have evened it out a little. But I think I did a pretty good job. Looked good to me. You know, it was fine.
Mia Farrow is my guest. Your first husband was Frank Sinatra. And you first met him when you were 11 and you were dining out with your father. Do you think he remembered meeting you?
Oh, probably not. I don't know. I never asked him. And I was too embarrassed to bring it up because it was when I was a kid. I guess I was about 11. So, but that was not too far, too many years before. You know, I met him when I was 19, so 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 8 years earlier. I didn't want to remind him that, you know, that I was that young, so I didn't bring it up.
As you mentioned earlier, a lot of people in the public were just astonished that the 50-year-old Frank Sinatra would be seeing and then marrying the, 20 or 20-something-year-old Mia Farrow. What was that age discrepancy like for you, that approximately 30-year difference?
Well, it really meant that we didn't have a shared history, that he had a history that I knew nothing about.
You didn't even know his records or his movies.
No, I didn't know those things, nor had I lived through, you know, the things that he had lived through. I mean, even culturally or, you know, in any way, historically, I didn't have the knowledge that he had in any way, his friendships, all those things. So, you know, you're left out of a great deal, and I think that plays itself out in lots of different ways. You know, when he met with friends and stuff, you know, the things that they would talk about, you know, I couldn't be a part of. So there is that always, and I guess that was the main thing. You know, that I just didn't know what he was talking about so much of the time.
Mia Farrow will be back with us in the second half of her show. Her new memoir is called What Falls Away. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come fly with me, let's fly away. Come fly with me, let's float down to Peru. In Llama Land, there's a one-man band and he'll toot his flute for you. Come fly with me, let's take off in the blue. Once I get you up there, where the air is rarefied, we'll just fly starry-eyed. Once I get you up there, I'll be holding you so near, you may hear.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the 30th anniversary reissue of the recording we're listening to now, New and Old Gospel, featuring Jackie McLean and Ornette Coleman. Kevin Whitehead has a review. Also, we continue our conversation with Mia Farrow.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with Mia Farrow. She's written a memoir called What Falls Away. When we left off, we were talking about her marriage to Frank Sinatra when she was in her early 20s and he was in his early 50s.
Was it hard being young and still in a lot of ways unformed, unsure of yourself as a woman, and, you know, in a relationship with a man who's incredibly famous, very secure in his own identity? I mean, his identity is iconic by that point.
I think you put your finger on the other thing, the just the feeling of inadequacy that would just swamp me all the time, because I was unformed and I didn't know what I wanted from life. I had no idea who I was. I wasn't even sure what I believed, you know, what my opinions were about things. And, you know, I was still very much learning, you know, so the way I viewed myself and my future, all of it, you know, I was so unsure of everything.
It always strikes me that in a relationship like that, the young woman is always at risk of having more of a mentor than a partner.
Yeah, that's true. It's a hard to, it can't be in, or I think it's difficult for it to be in an equal partnership. It would have been impossible for me because I deferred to him in all aspects.
Did you find that your husband was different when he was with the Rat Pack than when he was alone with you?
Yes, totally. The Rat Pack was an outside name, you know. Nobody used those
right.
words when I didn't even know about them until later, and I'm not sure exactly what it referred to. But in Las Vegas and on those sorts of evenings, all the guys. It was a very macho thing, you know. Mm-hmm. Guys would drink a lot and smoke a lot and tell jokes a lot, and the women would be very, very quiet, and they too would smoke and sip a little wine, spritzers, and, you know, just softly, maybe after a couple of hours, ask each other a couple of questions. But the women wouldn't even know each other. They were, you know, usually dates, a couple of times wives. But it was very male-dominated.
Well, during the period you were with Sinatra, you got the lead in Rosemary's Baby. And Sinatra said he couldn't picture you in the part, and you write you couldn't picture yourself in it either. Why not?
Because if someone says something like that, I'd automatically see their point of view, and then I take it on, or did. You know, I just didn't have a strong perception of what I could do, what I couldn't do, mm-hmm. what I was or wasn't. So, you know, I read the thing, and I thought, well, I'm going to try. And then he read the thing and said he couldn't see me in it, and then suddenly I couldn't see me in it either. It was just the way I was at the time.
But you did it anyways.
But I did it anyway. Yeah.
The film really holds up, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right. Also, not only from my own observations, but my kids, my older kids, I know they watch it with their friends asked me about it and, you know, continued to. When my kids went through teenage times and stuff, they would independently watch the movie. And so I know, you know, it's still alive, and they rent it in the video stores and watch it.
I have to say, I often think about you when I'm taking these really strange, like, herbal remedies for something.
Yeah.
I think of you leaning over the sink and eating the raw liver, or those horrible potions you had to carry around in the locket around your neck that were like the devil's potions. The tannis root, yes. I've had some remedies in my time that I thought it had to be as bad as that. You write in your book that you actually had to eat the raw liver during that scene.
Yeah, and I was a vegetarian at the time.
Ooh.
But it was supposed to be, wasn't it supposed to be like a chicken heart or something?
I don't remember. I just remember you eating it over the sink. And
I had to chew it up anyway, and then I'd spit it out in the sink.
Yeah. Oh.
Trooper that I was.
No, it must have been interesting working with the director Roman Polanski and with actor John Cassavetes, who played your husband in it. As you say in the book, Cassavetes, who is also a great director, liked a very improvisational style of acting, and Polanski was into 20 or 30 different takes of each scene, so they were at odds a lot. What was it like being in the middle of this?
Well, it was interesting. I mean, you know, it was two very, very different ways of approach, and I was fascinated by both men, and John was an amazing actor. But my allegiance was to our director, Roman Polanski. So I couldn't, you know, think about John's way of I mean, they were just openly in conflict after a while, and it was just embarrassing. I felt like I was watching television. I was miserable when they disagreed because I was very fond of both of them, and I admired both.
What was it like on a scene with Cassavetes after the 20th take when he would have preferred to be doing one take and have it be more improvisational?
Well, John felt it just killed the life in it, and he found it very difficult to act that way. He felt he wasn't doing his best, and therefore he was correct to question whether, you know, we should go on. But Roman would do, as I said, you know, 40 takes. So there really wasn't, I mean, Roman was the boss on the set. And John was very, you know, made it clear that he was very unhappy. He did it, but he was not happy about it.
Well, of course, in the movie, he plays an actor who makes a pact with the devil to become a better actor at your expense. tell me about the devil rape scene, what it was like shooting that. As you point out in your book, you were a veteran of convent school, and here you were. Getting raped by the devil and all the devil's minions.
It was embarrassing. It was embarrassing. But it was also very funny. I mean, this actor got right on top of me, and he had horizontal pupils and hair all over his face. And he was the devil, and he was just grinding away. And then at the end of it all, he climbs off me, and you know, they were untying my wrists and things, and he just extends his hand. He said, you know, Miss Farrow, it was a pleasure to have worked with you. You know, he was very polite and formal about it. Oh, Lord.
So it must be strange to show your children that scene.
Oh, I don't show them. I've never sat through Rosemary's Baby with my kids. But I just know the teenage kids have rented it and seen it on video. And, you know, it by today's standards, I suppose it isn't as, you know, as extreme as it seemed at the time.
Here's a scene from Rosemary's Baby. Rosemary doesn't realize she's pregnant with the devil's own baby, or that her neighbors, her doctor, and her husband Guy are in on the devil's conspiracy. But she knows that something's terribly wrong, and she's starting to distrust her doctor. Here's Mia Farrow and John Cassavetes.
Guy?
Yeah?
I'm going to Dr. Hill Monday morning. Dr. Saperstein is either lying or he's, I don't know, out of his mind. Pain like this is a warning something's wrong.
Rosemary.
And I'm not drinking Minnie's drink anymore. I want vitamins in pills like everyone else. I haven't drunk it for the last 3 days. I've thrown it away.
You what?
I've made my own drink.
Is that what those bitches were giving you in there? Is that their hint for today?
They're my friends. Don't
They're
call
a bunch
them bitches.
Of not very bright bitches who ought to mind their own goddamn business.
All they said was get a second opinion.
Rosemary, you got the best doctor in New York. You know who Dr. Hill is? He's a Charlie Nobody. That's who he is.
I'm tired of hearing how great Dr. Saperstein is.
Well, we'll have to pay Saperstein. We'll have to pay Hill. Well, it's out of the question.
I'm not changing. I just want to go to Dr. Hill and get a second opinion.
I won't let you do it, Rome. I mean, because it's not fair to Saperstein.
Not fair to... What are you talking about? What about what's fair to me?
If you want a second opinion, you tell Saperstein and let him decide.
No, I want Dr. Hill.
We'll talk more with Mia Farrow after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Mia Farrow. She's written an autobiography called What Falls Away. You started having children, both birth children and adopted children, during your second marriage to Andre Previn, the pianist, conductor, composer. When did you know that you wanted to have a lot of children?
I didn't. I just knew child by child, you know. I never had a master plan of how many children I would have. Andre and I wanted to enlarge our family, and we'd had, our twins were 3 years old, and the war was raging in Vietnam, and it just seemed, it seemed ridiculous to actually make a child when there were already children in the world needing homes. So we adopted two children from Vietnam, and they were an absolute delight, our daughters. And then we went on to adopt another child from Korea. Eventually, our marriage fell apart, but Andre and I remained good friends. And those children that I had brought me such pleasure. It was just such a delight. I so enjoyed them that I went on to adopt another son, Moses. And then years went by, and I didn't even think of it. And then as the children grew older, it occurred to me to again. I mean, I guess I just loved being a mother so much.
Did being a mother and having a constantly growing family affect your ambitions as an actress?
Oh, completely. I mean, the minute I had the twins, I think, you know, within, I mean, as soon as I really took stock of things after the birth of the twins, I realized to my amazement that they had eclipsed everything. I had thought that I was ambitious, but it turned out that I really wasn't. I wanted to be home with the kids.
When you met Woody Allen in 1980 and started working with him, did you feel that it was opening up a different side of you as an actress?
Not particularly. I feel that he gave me wonderful opportunities as an actress, but I don't, you know, I had had wonderful opportunities thus far also, and I'd spent years in England with the Royal Shakespeare Company and on the stage. I'd had terrific opportunities to expand as an actor. And he contributed to that enormously in the 13 films. You know, there were some especially that really were a stretch for me.
You write that as a director, he became a stranger to you, that he was really different as a director than he was as a companion or even as an actor.
Yeah, on the set, you know, he was especially stern and, you know, sort of chill. So, you know, that's just the way he works. I'm not faulting it, because he does a good job. He gets good performances, and, you know, but he is not, you know, warm with actors. There's not, you know, actors are scared on the set with him. He doesn't speak to them, really.
About his relationship with your daughter, Sunyi, you write, "He knew Sunyi as my daughter since she was 8 years old. What rage did he feel against me, against women, against mothers, against sisters, against daughters, against an entire family?" Do you feel like that's a question you can answer? Do you feel you understand?
No, I don't know what the source of that would be for him. I mean, I can speculate, but it wouldn't be fair to, you know, fiddle around with someone else's psyche. But, you know, it is quite frightening to speculate, you know, what sort of rage, where it comes from. You know, I try not to think about it.
Do you try not to think about your own rage?
Yeah, I find that it's pretty much passed through me. You know, I mean, of course there was outrage, but, you know, you move on. I have small children. I have a 3-year-old daughter. The demands of my day are such that I have to live in the present, and what my children demand of me and give to me keep me very much in the present and keep me, I think, from getting bitter or, you know, shriveling up in some negative way. I'm filled with positive, you know, ongoing celebrations. It's okay. I'm okay now.
Are you still in touch with your daughter, Sunyi?
No, she does not. She's not tried to get in touch with me at all. So it's been however long it's been, 4.5 years, I haven't heard from her.
You changed two of your children's names, Satchel's and Dylan's names. Why did you change them?
I didn't change them. In the middle of all the hoo-ha, on all the horror, Dylan came out with the fact, announced to the family, that she was changing her name and wanted to be called this other perfectly lovely name, and we just thought it was a passing thing. But she demanded to be called by this new name and then announced it at school and so forth. You know, as months went by, we all, at first jokingly and eventually completely, began to call her by this other name. Now, a year after that, first as a nickname, and it's, you know, now been 5 years, so it's a permanent thing. Then my son Satchel, a year later in the schoolyard, was teased by some kids, apparently repeatedly, about being a book bag. And so he then said, well, if Dylan changed her name, why can't I change my name? And I looked at him with real respect because I had actually had some trepidations about the name Satchel. And, I deferred to Woody Allen in the choice of that name. And I wasn't altogether on solid ground about that. And I just thought, well, yeah, I respect that. I don't want him to be teased in the schoolyard. And I'm not sure about that name Satchel either. Yeah. So since I had let Dylan change her name, and also, you know, something, it seemed a stroke of genius that Dylan changed her name. Because after all that stuff in the press, she's escaped that. Mm-hmm. She's got another name now.
Right, right. Here's a question I have. I know that a lot of people who go to Woody Allen films feel so ambivalent about Woody Allen. On the one hand, they like the work. On the other hand, they're horrified by his actions. I'm wondering for you, as an artist and as a person who was involved with him, how the movies look to you now, if you still like your work in the movies, if you could still watch the movies, if the work holds up to you, or if that's been poisoned by what happened in your family.
Well, frankly, if he's in the movie, I would find it hard to watch, and I have no desire to do so. I saw a little bit of Purple Rose of Cairo, which Woody Allen does not appear in, and I thought it was wonderful as a film. So, you know, I can see that that film was good, and I can say that some of those films that we did together were good ones. And I can also say that the work for me was satisfying. And, you know, hindsight hasn't spoiled that for me. I mean, I still feel those things. But, you know, I don't have any desire to go to Woody Allen movies, personally.
It just strikes me you've had some rough experiences with men dating back to your father, who you described as a womanizer. And I wonder if you feel like you feel you've been burned too many times. You know, if you feel distrustful of men, or if you still feel...
I'd say I feel distrustful of people, and I feel distrustful of myself, you know? I mean, I feel like if I didn't know, if I couldn't see what somebody was capable of after 12 years with, you know, in a relationship, why should I suppose that I would see what someone is now? And people do conceal themselves very cleverly. I mean, now I acknowledge that. So it would be difficult for me to begin a serious relationship again.
So are you saying you feel distrustful of people in general now because you realize what can be concealed?
Yeah. I have, with reason, you know. Yeah.
But, I mean, one of the people involved was your daughter. Do you feel distrustful of your children, too?
Well, I hope not. Goodness, I hope not. No, I mean, I feel I know my children pretty well. It does seem that anything can happen. You know, I'm trusting by nature. So, you know, maybe this has put me in a middle ground where most people are anyway. You know, maybe I was overly trusting. And you know, that could be that I'm in now where everybody else is, particularly people of my age. I don't know. I haven't, you know, trusted enough to really put it to the test.
Mia Farrow, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Mia Farrow has written a new autobiography called What Falls Away. Coming up, a reissue of a historic jazz recording. This is Fresh Air. Next month, March 24th, marks the 30th anniversary of a historic recording by two modern masters of the alto saxophone, Jackie McLean and Ornette Coleman. It's just been reissued. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says the record was a good idea, but there is a catch.
Jackie McLean on alto saxophone. He was a good match for his fellow altoist Ornette Coleman. Each had tinkered in his own way with the legacy of Charlie Parker, specifically the complicated sequences of chords Parker improvised from. McLean opted for simpler and gospel-oriented harmonies, the so-called hard bop style. Coleman wrote tunes that implied simple chord changes, but when improvising, he left himself free to modulate from one key to another, or to play an 8-bar passage in 7 or 9 bars if he wanted to, a style that required a rhythm section especially sensitive to his every move. McLean took the inside road and Coleman the outside, so recording together made sense, except for one thing. In order to keep his own playing fresh, back then Coleman was also playing violin and trumpet, despite his obvious limitations on either, and he decided to play trumpet on this session. If McLean had wanted a trumpet player, he knew better ones to ask, but why not? That's Offspring by Jackie McLean from his album New and Old Gospel, recently issued on CD by Blue Note. McLean and Ornette Coleman each wrote half of the program, and stylistically it falls somewhere between their respective styles. Actually, McLean tried to write like Coleman and vice versa. The gospel tune we heard at the beginning of this review was by Ornette. Drummer Billy Higgins had played a lot with both composers and had no trouble following either one. Pianist Lamont Johnson and bassist Scotty Holt were less experienced with Ornette's free bop style, and one of the best things about this record is hearing them try to fit in with Ornette. The pianist engages in a sort of dialogue with trumpet, playing lines more than chords. The bassist takes the opposite approach. hits a good groove and sticks with it no matter what. Gospel is one of those strange jazz records which is memorable precisely because the musicians are not on the same wavelength, a tradition which includes Coleman's own first recordings in the late 50s, some 1920s Louis Armstrong records, where he's swinging hard and the band isn't swinging at all, and a 1963 Albert Eiler LP, where the free jazz saxophonist and his polite Danish rhythm section sound like they're on different planets. Such recordings tend to occur when jazz is in transition between dominant styles, and what you hear is the sound of worlds in collision. It's not the perfectionist jazz some folks like, but it sure is fun to listen to. Oh, and one more thing. 30 years later, it would still be a good idea for Jackie McLean and Ornette Coleman to make a two alto saxophone record.
Kevin Whitehead is in Amsterdam working on a book. He reviewed New and Old Gospel on the Blue Note label. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Joan Tui Westman. Our engineers this week are Fritz Snyder, Chris Fraley, Al Banks, and Dan Lachlan. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.